Welcome to an FSN roundtable discussion special on how the UK beat the US and Europe to a COVID-19 vaccine. That's been the question plaguing officials in Brussels and Washington, who were apparently left blindsided by the efficiency with which Britain beat them to it. The UK's emergency authorization not only cleared the way for Britain to become the first Western country to allow mass vaccinations against COVID-19, but it also put immense pressure on US and EU regulators to move faster. I'm speaking to three of our global correspondents, Nick Harper in Washington, Tony Waterman in Brussels, and John Beaver in Bristol in the UK. John, how has Britain, which has struggled to contain the virus, much like Europe and America, and seemed to find it hard to get its act together on contact tracing and testing, how did Britain get there first?
Well, the education secretary said it was because Britain was a much better country. He later clarified those comments and said it was down to excellent medical and scientific experts. Other cabinet members have said it was because of Brexit that Britain was able to approve the vaccine so quickly, although actually there is some emergency legislation that allows all EU members to go it alone when it comes to distributing a vaccine during a pandemic. Certainly, though, it seems the UK was more willing to use that because of its departure from Europe. But if you listen to what the scientists say, then it seems to be a combination of factors. I think being a relatively small country means less paperwork and regulations, and that helps Britain move quickly. The deputy chief medical officer said it was simply because the UK was really, really organised. And that work started on getting ready for this moment back in March, when the vaccine development was only just starting. And the MHRA, which is the public body responsible for assessing vaccines, is well regarded as a world leader in the regulation of medicine. They certainly believe that they've been thorough when it comes to the approval process. And I think really that is why Britain finds itself as the first country to have approved the vaccine.
Tony, how was Britain's decision to go it alone? How was that viewed in Brussels?
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about Brussels, but I'm actually sitting in a car right now outside of the Pfizer production plant in Pers, Belgium, which is right outside of Antwerp. And we're going to be talking about the significance of this tiny, tiny little town a little bit later in the show. But the initial reaction out of Brussels was really one of shock, because not many people, if anyone, knew that this was coming. And then after the shock started to wear off, that is when the criticism started to roll out. As John mentioned, the UK used this fairly unknown tool, this piece of legislation, to allow it to pull this emergency lever. And it came across as this major coup for Boris Johnson, which, as you mentioned, has been heavily criticized for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. And it left the appearance, at least, of the EU being on the back foot. And it undermines the solidarity Europe so desperately tries to protect. So the European Medicines Agency, this is the EU drugs regulator, it fired off a statement fairly quickly saying that its approval process, which is much longer, is more rigorous. And this is true. This is a process which requires more evidence to be submitted, checks to be made. And it argues that this longer, more rigorous process instills trust and confidence in the public so that people will actually take this vaccine. On the other side of the coin, of course, is that the EMA just does not have this temporary authorization tool, which the UK used in its own toolkit. But you're right, the criticism coming from all different sectors. So you had the German MEP, Peter Lees, he's a member of Chancellor Merkel's party. He called this problematic, and he recommended that the other EU member states who also have this power not try to pull the same stunt. The former head of the EMA implied that the UK regulatory body didn't look thoroughly enough at the data submitted, so that it was taking on risk by not doing so. The German health minister said that it wasn't about being first, it was about being safe. So there was this sense in Brussels that this was quite a sneaky move for the UK to pull off, and one that they really don't want to see any of the other member states following.
And Nick, the FDA is set to make a decision on the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine on December 10th, with Moderna close behind. Why has the US process taken longer?
Well, Nina, you're right. They are saying, the FDA, that it all comes down to the way that the data has been scrutinized from these trials. So they point to the UK regulatory agency and they say that the fact that they started reviewing the data certainly helped them. The UK regulatory agency say that they carried out what they call a rolling review. So once each bit of data was available, they looked at it. Here in the US, instead, they look at the entire data set once the trial has actually ended. So in the UK, the regulators had seen the majority of the data before that final authorization paperwork even hit their desks. Another reason why it takes longer in the US is that the FDA also conducts its own analysis of companies' raw data. UK regulators instead rely on the data analysis that's put forward by the companies themselves. But it doesn't take away from the fact that here in the US, people are not happy. There has been a lot of time spent over the last few days on US TV networks holding panel discussions to try and break down that question of why the US was beaten by the UK to the authorization. The top infectious disease expert here in the US, Dr. Anthony Fauci, he's said that the UK regulators didn't scrutinize that data as carefully as the US. He said the FDA is doing it the correct way, but he's also made a comment saying that he felt the UK had rushed the approval. He since walked that back, putting out an apology of sorts, saying that was not meant to be a judgment of the way that the UK did it. But of course, there's also one other person who's very unhappy about being beaten by the Brits. That's President Trump. Twice in 2 days in the last week, he summoned the US Food and Drug Administration, the top person at the FDA, to the White House to explain essentially what went wrong.
John, and I gather that part of the UK's disgruntlement with Dr. Fauci was that they're worried that those sorts of comments about rushing things might fuel the anti-vaxxer movement. I mean, it's not completely straightforward, is it? Pfizer has cut its shipments in half because there was some issue with their raw materials and early production. Now that the vaccine has been approved, how are shots, how are these injections going to get into people's arms?
Well, yes, the initial excitement really about the beginning of the end of the pandemic, as many people saw it, has been tainted slightly by the incredibly difficult logistical challenges the UK now faces. And being at the forefront of this vaccine rollout, many people are expecting the UK to make mistakes that other countries will then learn from. Doses of the vaccine are in the country now. They're being held in a central facility. This vaccine, of course, has to be stored at a very, very cold temperature. And that is just adding to the challenges of distributing it. It seems that the first shots will actually be administered on Tuesday, is what we're being told at the moment. Government scientists have said the process should be as fast as possible and at the highest volume. They quite literally see this as a matter of life and death. There's heated debate now about who should be first in the queue to receive it, whether that's healthcare workers, such as doctors, or care home residents. But the bulk of the rollout across the UK will probably be next year. The extreme cold needed to store the vaccine, as I said, and how quickly it has to be used, all adding to the challenge. So government scientists are warning that it could take until April for those deemed most at risk to actually receive the new vaccine.
Tony, you're at the epicentre of Pfizer's global vaccine production line in Belgium. Tell us a bit about how locals are reacting to the fact that all these vaccines are being produced there, but they themselves presumably can't get a shot anytime soon.
Well, I think when you talk to the people on the street, certainly when I was speaking with them today, everybody really has this sense of pride that this little tiny town in the Flemish-speaking part of Belgium is now has the world's eyes on them. I spoke to the mayor of the town today. He said, "We're out to save the world." And he's going to be entertaining six camera crews today alone. So we really do have the eyes of the world there. But at first glance, this is a town where if you've never heard of it, you are not alone, certainly. And up until a month ago, it was best known for its white asparagus and its hair-raisingly strong Duvel beer. I think about 8.5% alcohol content, but is now ground zero for really global hopes of escaping the harrowing effects of the coronavirus pandemic. It's home to what is one of the largest Pfizer production and packaging sites in the world. And it's turning out vaccines. You mentioned that the target number of those doses has been halved for this year, but they're still churning them out. Hundreds of thousands of them have been produced. They're on the move throughout Europe already. 800,000 of those are expected to go to the UK alone. But this is a city, a town that is so tiny, just a population of 17,000. 3,000 of them work at the factory here. It's something that didn't shut down during the pandemic. So it helped keep this economy here in this local town afloat. And I mean, accounts for up to 10% of the local government's tax revenue. I mean, it's this classic story of small town, big manufacturer coming in. And I mean, there still is a sense, even though those numbers are a bit lower, that they're playing quite an important role in this pandemic.
Nick, how can a country which has so far utterly failed to rein in the pandemic now be trusted to roll out a vaccine with efficiency and precision?
Well, Nina, I think simply put, trust on that issue is currently severely lacking in the US. Let's not forget that 14 million people have been affected, around 280,000 people have died. We're seeing new records for daily deaths, about 3,000 people dying in a single day. The hospitals are swamped, the ICU units are running out of beds. These are staggering numbers. And there are predictions that it could get even worse. Potentially, we could see 400,000 people in total dead in the US by the time Joe Biden enters the White House on January the 20th. So we've got a virus that's running rampant and a president who's still in charge for another month and a half, but essentially seems to have abdicated any sort of responsibility for this pandemic. He seems to be making no efforts to slow the spread of it. And he's only really weighing in from a political point of view. He reportedly feels that the FDA has been deliberately dragging their feet on approving these vaccines because reportedly he wants as many people to get as vaccinated before he leaves office, so that he gets the credit rather than his successor, Joe Biden. And let's not forget the logistical challenge that the US will face on these vaccine rollout. It's a huge country. 330 million people will need to get vaccinated. And as John mentioned a moment ago, there is that question of who goes first. The US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they said that healthcare workers and people living in care homes should go first. But then who goes next? There's a question of whether that should be communities of color. They've been disproportionately affected by this pandemic. But at the same time, those are the very communities where there's a high level of distrust about vaccinations, Black and Latino communities. There's been a survey of Black adults showing that less than half of them would get vaccinated even if the vaccination was free. So it's a huge problem that the US will have to grapple with over the coming months. And it's still waiting for approval of those vaccines.
John, I want to come back to you on the question of inequity. What sort of debate is taking place in the UK about its global commitments to the developing world? And is there any discussion about this every man for himself approach when it comes to the global vaccine alliance?
Well, last month, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister here, said that Britain was in the lead, not just inventing vaccines, but in making sure the poorest and neediest around the world get those vaccines. Certainly as well, I think it's fair to point out that the vaccine being developed here by the University of Oxford in conjunction with AstraZeneca will be made available at a much lower price than other vaccines. The company have said they want to make 3 billion doses by early next year. That would be enough to vaccinate around 20% of the whole population of the world. But of course, that's what's being said, but what will actually happen, many people are saying, well, it really is every man for himself. Despite signing up to COVAX and promising help, certainly the government here has got a UK first attitude towards vaccination, and they don't seem to be apologetic about that. It's very much they're trying to sort themselves out first and then help others. But of course, you're going to see a much more positive spin put on it by politicians when they're asked that question.
And Tony, back to Europe, how far off are we from seeing airlines demand vaccine passports in order to be able to travel?
It's something that's certainly being discussed and they'd like to see. The WHO, though, doesn't recommend that countries or airlines use these immunity passports for people who received the COVID-19 vaccine or people that perhaps have even recovered from COVID already. But what they say we could use, potentially they're looking into, is perhaps an e-vaccination certificate. as countries start to come online with these massive vaccination programs. Estonia and the WHO in October, they started a pilot project for something along these lines. It's a digital vaccine certificate. They call it a smart yellow card that would be used. You could use it across different countries, which is part of the problem. How interlopable are these digital devices, these digital passports going to be? But the airlines industry certainly was one of the first to suffer and will be amongst the last to recover. The IATA, which is the Association for the Airlines, estimates that $120 billion in losses will be registered for this year alone. And it's unsure how quickly the airlines industry or any part of the tourism industry is going to be able to recover, because these vaccines are going to be limited in supply when they first start rolling out. And they're also going to be going to the elderly, to care homes, to frontline workers, and people with comorbidities. So it's going to be sort of the last priority for governments to be giving people this jab so that they can start traveling again. So most of the governments here are saying, you know, maybe not until next spring, next summer, are we really going to start to see a return to some sort of normality. But of course, it's not going to be a full return, because indications are already showing us in Europe that up to 50% of people in a number of countries are still very unsure about getting vaccinated. And if there is this perception that the drugs regulators are very swift in their approval process on a vaccine which has already been developed at a record pace, that could even slow down the inoculations even further.
And Nick, despite the health warnings, millions of Americans are traveling. They travel for Thanksgiving. They're about to travel for Christmas. What sort of demands might we see from the travel industry for a vaccine passport in America?
Well, the US Travel Association, they haven't come out yet and said that they would want something like this, a vaccination passport. But they have said that more needs to be done, essentially at a federal government level. They've said that what we have in the United States, the fact that each individual state, all 50 of them, can decide their own rules, they say that that patchwork way of approaching things is confusing. They say that it discourages travel. But I think, like you mentioned, many, many people are still traveling. Many people are essentially viewing the situation as life as normal. We had those 50 million people who traveled during Thanksgiving, about 6 million alone by air, according to figures. And yes, we have the Christmas travel season just around the corner. We've got students coming back from universities and colleges right across the US. There is real concern that this huge movement of people, these people who are essentially looking at the situation and feeling as if life has returned to normal when it hasn't, there is this concern that it will cause a tremendous spike, that the next couple of months before Joe Biden comes in will be a very significant time for the United States, and predictions that it will get a lot worse in terms of infections and deaths. It's not a rosy picture here from the US.